I'm Natalie Morales of 48 Hours. So much of our reporting focuses on the stories of victims who didn't survive. But what about those who lived to tell?
I survived a violent home invasion. There's no earthly reason why I'm alive.
From 48 Hours, this is It Could Have Been Me.
It makes you grateful for everything you have, you know.
You can follow and listen to It Could Have Been Me on Tuesdays in the 48 Hours podcast feed on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
So, I'm going to be honest, Mike. When I think about psychedelics, I tend to think of my friends who loved going to fish concerts or of head shops and tie-dye, not necessarily academic halls and hospitals. How about you?
You know, I think of a trip my wife and I took once to Amsterdam, walking down the street past these shops with big glass jars in the windows filled with magic mushrooms. But no, you're right. Not anything legitimate like colleges and hospitals.
But we've actually found that psychedelics are not just something to enjoy while seeing the dead and company. In fact, more universities are offering programs to study these substances and how they can be used in clinical applications.
Earlier this year, Odyssey reported on the California Institute of Integral Studies' new accredited bachelor's degree in psychedelic research, first of its kind in the U.S.
Although the California Institute of Integral Studies' bachelor degree program is a first, other institutions have been paving a way for psychedelic research as well. There's the Naropa Center for Psychedelic Studies in Boulder, Colorado, the Psychoactive Pharmaceutical Investigation Master's Degree at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Psychiatry,
and the University of Colorado at Denver Center for Psychedelic Research. I spoke with Jim Grigsby. He is the executive director of the center, which offers a certificate program in the study of psychedelics, specifically why they are so important to study. This isn't exactly new, is it?
No, it's not. Some of the earliest work with psychedelics was actually a little bit in the 1930s with mescaline. Things took off after the synthesis of LSD, which was in 1938 in Basel, Switzerland. It took a while. They didn't realize until 1943 the properties of LSD. And once they did, that's when research began to really take off. Initially, they thought it might make a good, what they were referring to as a model of psychosis. And the technical term for that was a psychotomimetic. And they realized pretty quickly that it really wasn't bad at all. And starting about 1950, psychiatrists began to use LSD, and some were using mescaline, to try to treat psychiatric disorders. And in particular, they started out with psychotic disorders like schizophrenia.
It's interesting. It sounds like you're saying, and I don't think a lot of people are aware of this, it had a fairly lengthy medical history before people started using it recreationally, correct?
That's correct, yeah. In fact, there were, I don't recall exactly, but well over 1,000 published studies early on. So by 1972, I think there may have been 2,000, maybe 3,000 published research studies on one or another psychedelic.
That's amazing. And CU, Den, tell me what's going on in Denver right now at CU.
Okay, we've got, let's see, it started out with just some small studies on the medical school campus. That's been in the last couple of years. Psychiatrists there have been studying the use of psilocybin for treating treatment-resistant depression.
Psilocybin is also known as those aforementioned magic mushrooms.
According to the University of Utah, those fungi had been used by indigenous cultures of Mesoamerica for centuries before they became well known in Western culture during the 1960s and 70s.
And today, people often consume them for their hallucinogenic effects, as well as their ability to create a euphoric mood. Now, they can also cause side effects such as nausea, and the potency varies from mushroom to mushroom.
However, use of these mushrooms rarely results in life-threatening symptoms.
Here's how Dr. Grigsby got involved in studying the potential for substances like LSD and psilocybin in medical settings.
Our own work began somewhat before that. I teamed up with a colleague of mine from the Department of Medicine out of the medical school named Stacy Fisher. She's a physician there who works in particular with people who have cancer, and especially with palliative care, which for people with cancer essentially means end-of-life treatment. And so beginning in about 2019, I believe, seems like it was just pre-pandemic, you know, we thought to do this because there was some old research on it, dating back to the 1960s and 70s, in which LSD in particular was used with people who had cancer.
I'm Natalie Morales of 48 Hours. So much of our reporting focuses on the stories of victims who didn't survive. But what about those who live to tell?
I survived a violent home invasion. There's no earthly reason why I'm alive.
From 48 Hours, this is It Could Have Been Me.
It makes you grateful for everything you have, you know.
You can follow and listen to It Could Have Been Me on Tuesdays in the 48 Hours podcast feed on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
So we began writing grant proposals to the National Cancer Institute, which is part of NIH, requesting money to do a clinical trial of that. And so we got funded about 2.5 years ago.
Tell me this, with regards to cancer, you mentioned that, would psychedelics be used to treat pain? And if so, how would they be different than, say, marijuana?
Okay, so they have been used to treat pain. Actually, one of the earliest studies on this with cancer patients was done by a guy named Eric Cast in Chicago. Starting in 1964, he published two or three papers where he looked at people who had terminal cancer, and he was interested in part in seeing whether or not depression was improved. He also looked at pain, and it turned out that in his research, LSD was a better analgesic, a better pain reliever than either Demerol or Dilaudid, which are a couple of fairly strong opioids.
Since Dr. Grigsby brought up pain, I thought it would be good to mention here that as of 2023, nearly a quarter of U.S. adults struggled with chronic pain. That's according to the CDC.
And when people with pain are prescribed opioids, they're at risk for becoming dependent on them. Data published by the National Library of Medicine indicates that more than 2 million people battle opioid use disorders in the U.S. It's a situation that has been called a crisis. It's one of the reasons why scientists are eager to study potential alternatives for managing pain and why degree programs are popping up. In some cases, they've even studied whether psychedelics can help people with opioid addictions curb their use.
While there is research that indicates psychedelics can help people who suffer with pain, people often think of them more as party drugs than medicines, as I mentioned at the top of the show. Additionally, controversy over the early days of psychedelic research under Timothy Leary, I'm sure some of our listeners have heard about him, he was at Harvard in the early 1960s, that controversy has impacted research, according to a 2022 article from Harvard itself.
Have you gotten any pushback from people who say, this is wrong, you shouldn't be doing this, you shouldn't be messing around with this stuff? And similarly, are there possible patients out there who are reluctant because of that stigma?
You know, there's a little bit of that, kind of a holdover from the 60s and 70s and the drug war. I think, though, that the number of people who feel that way, both mental health and other providers, healthcare providers, have begun to recognize the utility of this. So when we were first trying to get funded by the NIH, that was a common comment that we got from reviewers of our grant proposals. that this is not a good thing to do. And in fact, the person who is the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse had just put her foot down and said that there's no way that NIDA, just what that organization was called, was ever going to fund any sort of work with psychedelics.
But then something changed.
A few years ago, the director of NIH, Francis Collins, told a Senate committee on the budget that, in fact, they considered LSD important both for basic science about the brain and as a potential therapeutic intervention. And that, plus a lot of favorable publicity over the last several years, has, I think, really turned attitudes around a lot.
Now, one lingering stigma around LSD is part of the reason why current research into psychedelics has focused on those magic mushrooms we talked about earlier in the show.
A lot of people were concerned about the bad rap that LSD had gotten, and most people didn't even know what psilocybin was. So for that reason, and because LSD tends to last 7 to 9 hours, whereas psilocybin lasts maybe 5 to 6 or 7, psilocybin is what most people have studied in the last 20, 25 years.
Tell me about the results so far. Does this approach with psychedelics seem to be working?
There are a number of different disorders that have been studied, and an increasing number are coming under investigation. One drug that's not really a psychedelic, it's sometimes included with them, but it's actually thought of more as what they call an entheogen or empathogen, is MDMA. And it's a variant on an amphetamine, so a stimulant, but it has demonstrated very good efficacy in treating post-traumatic stress disorder. Last August, the FDA reviewed the research on it to determine whether they should approve it for more widespread use. For various reasons, they voted that down. But they didn't rule it out. They insisted that instead they'd like to have more research to verify the effectiveness of it.
As far as you're concerned, then, the more study on this, the better.
Yeah, for a number of reasons, both to understand what conditions it works for, what it doesn't work for, what the positive and negative effects are, and really to understand the mechanism by which it works. And just give us a fuller understanding of the drugs and their effects.
And Lauren, before we close, full disclosure, as you and I are recording this right now, I'm suffering from a pretty bad kidney stone flare-up. You've had kidney stones, right?
I have not. My best friend has, and they're awful. And I'm feeling pain for you vicariously.
They're incredibly painful. And the doctor earlier this week, he did prescribe opioids. He gave me some Vicodin, and I have taken a couple of them. But I have to say, you know, maybe if there'd been a big jar of magic mushrooms in the house, I might have gone that route.
I don't blame you for taking Vicodin for kidney stones, though. Go for it until they're better.
That and a hot bath. It'll do it every time. I'm Mike Rogers. Thank you for listening to Something Offbeat. This episode written and produced by Lauren Barry and Chris Blake. Audio editing by Chris Blake and original music by Myron Kaplan. Now to keep listening, please subscribe to us on the Odyssey app, Spotify, Apple, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have your own offbeat story that you think we should cover, send it to us at somethingoffbeat@odacy.com.
A quick note from Something Offbeat. If you have kidney stones, please consult your doctor before taking any medication.
I'm Natalie Morales of 48 Hours. So much of our reporting focuses on the stories of victims who didn't survive. But what about those who live to tell?
I survived a violent home invasion. There's no earthly reason why I'm alive.
From 48 Hours, this is It Could Have Been Me.
It makes you grateful for everything you have, you know.
You can follow and listen to It Could Have Been Me on Tuesdays in the 48 Hours podcast feed on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.